This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll discuss the recent verdict against the Holy Land Charity that is bound to have a chilling effect on the Muslim community. We'll speak with journalist Leila El-Aryan and also Linda Moreno, an attorney in the case. We'll look at the practice of preemptive pardons and how to stop. We speak with Congressman Gerald Nadler, who recently proposed House Resolution 1531, demanding that Bush refrain from issuing preemptive pardons of senior officials in his administration. We'll also hear excerpts from a New York University Law School event titled Torture, a Harper's Magazine forum on justice in the post-Bush era. Stay with us. A few updates, one specifically involving the increase of hate crimes. Since Barack Obama won the presidential election, incidents of race crimes around the country have been on the rise. According to Mark Potok, director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center, there have been hundreds of such crimes since the election, many more than is usual. And they have been aimed directly at President-elect Obama. For example, school children have chanted "Assassinate Obama," while college students at North Carolina State University admitted writing anti-Obama comments in a public area designated for free speech, including one that urged, quote, "Let's shoot that N-word in the head." Authorities say that Obama has already received more threats than any other president-elect. In Standish, Maine, a sign outside a store read, "Osama Obama Shotgun Pool." Store patrons could sign up to bet $1 on the date when he would be killed. The sign listed stabbing, shooting, and roadside bombs as possible methods of assassination. Racist graffiti has been found from Long Island to Texas to Los Angeles. Cars, sidewalks, and houses have been defaced with racial slurs and slogans such as, quote, "Go back to Africa." Black figures have been hanged by nooses from trees in Maine. And a professor at the University of Alabama found a poster of the Obama family ripped from her office door. A replacement poster was later defaced with a racial slur and a death threat. Crosses have been burned as far north as in the yards of Obama supporters in Hardwick, New Jersey, and in Pennsylvania. Threats were left in a note on a car windshield in Pittsburgh's Forest Hills, reading, "Now that you voted for Obama, just watch out for your house." In his intelligence report, Mark Potok writes, "Even as we embark on a new national adventure, the signs are worrying. It may be that the hate mongers are wrong, that Americans' better angels will prevail, and the changes that are sweeping America will not result in a growing rage on the right. But experience tells us that while we hope for the best, we must also prepare for what could be a dangerous, racially motivated backlash of hate." Last week, a full 12-judge panel of the 2nd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals reheard and reconsidered an earlier decision in the case of Maher Arar. Listeners will recall that Maher Arar is the Canadian man accused of terrorism and sent to be tortured in Syria. Noted constitutional attorney David Cole of the Center for Constitutional Rights argued that Arar had been falsely accused and said, quote, "There was an intentional conspiracy to subject Arar to torture, and there was an intentional conspiracy to keep him from having access to the courts." The court had earlier decided to reject the lawsuit, with a 3-judge panel saying that allowing it to proceed would harm national security. This past June, an appeals court upheld that decision. Last week's oral argument urged the court to reinstate the lawsuit against high-ranking officials in the Bush administration who were responsible for sending him to be tortured in Syria. Arar, who is 38 years old, was unable to attend the proceedings because he remains on a no-fly list. Arar had been apprehended at JFK Airport based on faulty information that he had links to Al-Qaeda on his way back to Montreal from a family holiday in Tunisia in September 2002. He was repeatedly interrogated, given limited access to his lawyer and relatives, and was put on a private airplane and taken to Syria. For 10 months, much of his time was spent in a cell the size of a grave. He was beaten frequently and whipped with an electrical cable. As a signatory to the International Convention Against Torture, the U.S. has a legal obligation to avoid sending detainees to country that will torture them. In Canada, an inquiry under Justice Dennis O'Connor exonerated Arar, who received a formal apology and over $10 million in compensation from Ottawa. The lawsuit, filed in 2004, names former Attorney General John Ashcroft, former Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson, FBI Director Robert Mueller, former Homeland Security Tom Ridge, and many U.S. immigration officials. Last month, a jury in Dallas, Texas, found five Palestinian men guilty of more than 100 charges in the nation's largest terrorism financing trial since 9/11. We talk with Leila El-Aryan, a Washington-based journalist who recently wrote a powerful alternate article about this case and its impact on Muslim charities. We also talk with Linda Moreno, one of the lawyers in the case. As many listeners may know, Holy Land was the largest Muslim charity in the United States. The Bush administration shut it down after the September 11th attacks and arrested five officials from the charity. In her article, El-Aryan describes how the prosecution introduced unrelated and inflammatory video to emotionally sway the jurors. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
This was the second trial against Holy Land. Can you briefly describe what happened in the first trial?
Sure. Basically, five Palestinian American men were arrested because they were at one point either worked for or were founders of the Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development, which is the largest American Muslim charity until it was closed in December of 2001. This charity gave over $50 million to needy people all over the world, including Bosnia, including victims of the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, as well as Palestinians who were living in the occupied territories in the West Bank and Gaza. And even in the indictment, if you look at what the men were actually charged with doing, the U.S. government actually admits that all of that money, the $12 million that was donated to Palestinians, all went to charity, all went to needy people, whether it was hospitals or libraries or school supplies or even just providing food and shelter to needy Palestinians. However, the government's theory is that this money is fungible in that by giving it to the Zakat committees that were supposedly tied to Hamas, that actually freed up money for violence. Now, what's interesting is that these same Zakat committees, the U.S. government, USAID, and the International Red Cross also donated to. What the defendants say is that there's absolutely no connection between the Zakat committees and Hamas, and that the government failed to prove that connection. Now, the first trial last year, after a month of deliberations, the jury came back and there was a mistrial. Initially, all the jurors wanted to acquit the defendants, the vast majority of charges. However, one juror, after the jury was pulled, changed her mind. And when you actually see interviews with William Neal, one of the jurors who was really pushing for full acquittal of the defendants, he said that this woman was obstinate. She refused to say why she wanted to convict the men. She relied basically on her gut feelings, and that was why she was pushing for conviction. So the trial ended in mistrial, and this past September, the men were retried once again in Dallas, Texas. And there was a different jury, of course, and this time they came back with full convictions against everyone.
Now, that's what we want to sort of get at. Why? How do you explain the different outcomes?
That's actually something that Linda Moreno, one of the defense attorneys, said. You know, it's mind-boggling how in one trial a jury comes back with no convictions against anybody, and in the second trial you have every single person was convicted of all the charges. I think what happens if you talk to people who are, you know, who either tried the case or observed it. I went to Dallas, Texas as a producer with Al Jazeera English, and I spoke with a lot of the supporters, people who were carrying banners every single day saying that charity to orphans is not a crime, and that, you know, do you ask a child what his religion is before you feed him, these types of things. And they said that it was basic fear-mongering by the government. They were showing a lot of videos that were supposedly Hamas-affiliated that were showing things that I think to the Western eye may look disturbing, but if you've been living under occupation for decades and decades, you know, this is sort of what happens.
Give us an example.
Such as, you know, kindergartners reenacting military situations, wearing military fatigues, things like that. They were also showed videos of bus bombings. I think at one point the government recreated a bus bombing and they showed that video. And of course the government didn't even allege that the men had any connection to violence. But this was simply fear-mongering. They also brought in two witnesses from Israel. One of them was testified as an expert witness. His name is Avi. That's his pseudonym. We don't actually know what his real name is. And he was a Shin Bet agent. And no one knows his real name, like I said. And from what the defense attorneys tell me, this is the first time that they know of in any American courtroom that an expert witness, not a fact witness, testified under a pseudonym. No one knows his real identity.
There are multiple problems with that, obviously. How do we hold such a person accountable for perjury?
Absolutely. Also, the defense attorneys, how are you going to cross-examine someone when you don't even know who he is? You don't know his background. You're not able to research who he is. You know, he could commit perjury and he won't face any kind of consequences. And the defense attorneys did prove that he ended up lying to the jury about the Zakat committees being tied to Hamas. The other person who came from Israel was named Major Lior. Again, it was a pseudonym. And he was the person who commanded one of the operations in the West Bank. I think it was against the Jenin refugee camp. And that's when some of these, you know, so-called evidence trying to connect the Zakat committees to Hamas were seized. And again, I mean, this is someone, you're in a situation of war, situation of occupation, and you're bringing people in who have a clear stake in this political situation. So you're... what you're really doing is you're prosecuting the Palestinian-Israeli conflict in an American courtroom, which a lot of people are disturbed by.
Prosecutors told the jury that the programs were controlled by Hamas, which is listed as a terrorist organization by the State Department. But Edward Abington, who's the former number two intelligence official, told jurors that he was not told that the Palestinian charity committees supported by Holy Land were part of Hamas.
Right. Well, if the U.S. government really believed that these Zakat committees, and I should just define the word Zakat, it means charity in Arabic. It's one of the five major pillars of Islam. So for Muslims, giving charity is a religious obligation. And this Holy Land Foundation was one of the premier Muslim charities in America. So after this charity was shut down, I mean, it really limits people's options as far as where to donate, where to help needy people. So if the U.S. government really believed these Zakat committees were in fact tied to Hamas, A, they would have designated the Zakat committees in their designations. And you know, our government never hesitates to do that if they really had the evidence. And secondly, we wouldn't donate to these very same Zakat committees. That's what's so mind-boggling about this case, is that we ourselves are giving money to these organizations that were... So it's a clear case of selective prosecution. And also, the way where the U.S. government is trying to prove that these are indeed Hamas-affiliated is through the testimony of an Israeli witness. That testimony cannot be authenticated because he is anonymous. And B, it's a situation of war where he clearly has a stake in this, and it's obviously in his best interest to say whatever the government wants him to say.
What is the next step in terms of legal proceedings? Will there be an appeal?
There will be an appeal. There are very strong grounds for appeal, including this disturbing and unprecedented testimony by an anonymous Israeli Shin Bet agent who was an expert witness. We don't know what happened in the jury room, so if it turns out that there was any kind of, you know, intimidation or anything, that would be grounds for appeal. So I know the lawyers are definitely confident that this could get turned over on appeal, but as you know, that could take a while. Now, the sentencing will probably be sometime in the spring, so I'm confident that, you know, that will also be, they'll make a very strong case that, you know, there were a lot of very troubling things that happened in the case. Shouldn't be sentenced harshly.
Now, what effect is this going to have on other charities, do you think?
Well, not only are Muslim charities worried, but I think even non-Muslim charities are worried, given, like I mentioned, the International Red Cross gives to these very same Zakat committees in the Palestinian territories. So I think there definitely is a chilling effect. I think people are worried that they're next. I think that's part of the reason why these cases are prosecuted, because they are such high-profile cases. President Bush himself commented on it. Joe Lieberman, the senator, even commented on the verdict, saying that it was a great day for America or something to that respect. So I think these cases are really used to instill fear in people's hearts and hesitancy as far as actually getting involved and donating to people who need it the most. I mean, look at what's happening in Gaza today. People are without power, without food, without jobs, and they need this type of aid more than ever. But my fear is that it's going to dry up, and this is, like I said, we're prosecuting the conflict in an American courtroom, and all they want is to try to punish people who are suffering and to punish those who want to help them.
Leila, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
We're now joined by Linda Marino to discuss more of the details in the Holy Land case. Linda, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. So good to be with you.
You were one of the defense attorneys in the Holy Land case. Can you describe what role you played?
I represent Ghassan Elashi. Mr. Elashi was the chairman of the board of the Holy Land Foundation. He was with the Holy Land Foundation from its inception until its closure in 2001, a period of 12 years.
Were you involved in the first trial?
I was. I was his counsel in the first trial, which you may know ended in a series of acquittals on several counts, and the jury hung on all the rest.
Obviously, we had two different juries, two different outcomes. Was the presentation of evidence different in the second trial?
It was somewhat different, both from the defense perspective and from the prosecution. But really, the prosecution's case was really quite similar. And in fact, although they said that they had pared down their evidence, it really took about the same period of time. In this particular retrial, they introduced who they called an insider, a convicted felon, who talked about the Holy Land case and made the bald assertion that the Holy Land knew that these Zakat committees were Hamas and funneled money to the Zakat committees because they were Hamas. We proved in cross-examination, of course, that was not true and really speculative on his part. And additionally, this was a witness who pled guilty to a charge that carried an incarcerative term of life. And by the time he had been testifying in the Holy Land trial, after testifying in the Mohammed Salah case in Chicago, his sentence was now down to 92 months. So he was working off his sentence in his testimonies at these various trials.
That's quite an incredible downward departure in his sentencing.
Right, from life to 92 years. And as I told the jury in closing, he wasn't done yet. We may see Mr. Shorbaji making an appearance, a cameo in other trials around the country, unfortunately.
Now, I am aware that there was videotape evidence that may have been extremely prejudicial.
The government began its case conceding that none of the gentlemen on trial had ever participated in any violence, period. You're also talking about a criminal investigation that lasted 12 years in terms of the wiretap evidence and the surveillance evidence. And my client, Ghassan Elashi, along with the other gentlemen, were never caught on tape extolling the virtue of suicide bombing or any violence. You know, what they were talking about was the Palestinian issue, the horror of the brutal military occupation. The government began its case with its first exhibit, which was a photograph of a bombed-out bus, which, of course, had nothing to do with the accused in the Holy Land case. And they continued to introduce a plethora of extremely inflammatory and prejudicial evidence of violence. In the middle of our trial, a very important decision came down in the second Circuit of New York called Al-Moyad. And Al-Moyad is the first terrorism conviction, Heidi, that has been overturned, reversed. This case was reversed because of this evidence of violence that the government introduced that really had nothing to do with Mr. Al-Moyad. So So when that case came down, we started making what we called the El-Mayad objections. And we believe this is an important issue for appeal. There were no videos of suicide bombers, but there were videos of children doing skits. Really, you're talking about an art form that is a result of a culture under occupation.
A culture that is very difficult for Americans to understand.
And as I said to the jury, you know, in America, children, American kids and teenagers, they have violent video games that they can play and play all day long, but they get to turn that off at night, and they get to go back to the safety and sanctuary of their homes and their bedrooms and shut the door. When you're a Palestinian child, you don't have that luxury.
Linda, this brings up a notion of charities under fire. What effect do you think this will have in the future?
Well, I mean, I think that certainly there were charities around the world who were watching what was going on with the Holy Land case. We know, because we proved in the trial, in both trials, that the United States government, through USAID and other organizations, was giving to the exact same Zakat committees that were at issue and at play in the indictment in this case. And the notion that you have to vet the recipient of charitable donations, I believe, is un-American. That's why I believe that the Holy Land case is a case that all Americans should pay attention to and watch very carefully. There's just something wrong about criminalizing humanitarian aid. And I said to the jury, perhaps my client and the other gentleman just fed the wrong people, that Palestinians don't deserve to be helped.
Linda, is your approach going forward going to differ in any way from the previous trials?
I actually will be involved in some other similar trials. What I can tell you for the Holy Land is the next step, of course, is the appeal. We believe it's a very meritorious appeal. There are issues of first impression in this case, and this is a case that may go all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. We believe very, very strongly in it.
You're heroes to all of us here on Law and Disorder. This was a huge blow to not only the Palestinian community, but those of us in this country who believe in fairness and justice.
Thank you. To me, the real heroes are these gentlemen.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being on Law and Disorder, Linda.
Bye-bye.
So far, George W. Bush has issued nearly 170 pardons, including one to a Missouri farmer who unintentionally poisoned three bald eagles. Pardons give the recipients greater leeway to find jobs, to live in public housing, and to vote. Many expect that President Bush will pardon himself and other high officials as a shelter from criminal charges. That's what New York Congressman Gerald Nadler is trying to prevent. Nadler is the chair of the Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties, and he's recently introduced House Resolution 1531, demanding that Bush refrain from issuing preemptive pardons of senior officials in his administration during the final 90 days of office. The legislation, quote, aims to prevent undeserved pardons of officials who may have been co-conspirators in the president's unconstitutional policies, such as torture, illegal surveillance, and curtailing of due process for defendants. We talk with Congressman Nadler about what effect this resolution will have on the president's pardon power. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Congressman. Could you explain the essence of House Resolution 1531?
The House Resolution 1531 has a lot of whereas clauses, you know, setting forth the facts, but urges ultimately that the president not issue a preemptive pardons to senior officials of his own administrations for acts they may have taken in the course of their official duties. It says that this is a dangerous abuse, or would be a dangerous abuse of the pardon power. So it says the president should not do that, and it would be an abuse of the pardon power. Secondly, it says that we believe the attorney general should appoint an independent counsel, a special prosecutor, to investigate various alleged crimes, warrantless wiretapping, torture, rendition, and so forth committed during the Bush administration. And third, it urges appointment of a special commission to look into all of this.
Has anyone in the past ever issued so-called preemptive pardons?
Oh, sure. President Ford pardoned President Nixon for any crimes which he might have committed, which is the definition of a preemptive pardon, with respect to Watergate. President Bush, the first President Bush, pardoned Caspar Weinberger and Elliot Abrams and various other people for any crimes they might have committed in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. A good use of the pardon power in a preemptive pardon was President Carter, who in 1977 or 78 pardoned anyone who may have violated the draft laws to evade the draft during the Vietnam War, and that enabled a number of people to come home from Canada.
In this instance, a pardon might be seen then as an admission by President Bush of wrongdoing by his administration, which he's denied.
It could be seen, but it would not be admitted as such. In other words, he would say, or he could say, while we did nothing wrong, it would be wrong for alumni of my administration who are high officials to be hounded by politically motivated prosecutions for work that they did in patriotically, opposing the terrorists. So they did nothing wrong, but I don't want them hounded.
Right. So it's sort of a blanket provision,
protection. Now, my feeling is the reason for pardons, for giving the president the pardon power in the first place, is that you want to temper justice with mercy. And that makes sense. There are times and places for that. But it would be an abuse of power to pardon people, first of all, before they're convicted of a crime. But second of all, to pardon officials of your own administration in order to, or maybe not in order to, but with the appearance of covering up crimes. Let's assume that the president conspired with various people in his administration to commit crimes. If he then pardoned all the people, well, how do you normally develop a case? You get people to testify about others involved in the conspiracy, and you normally go up the chain. But if you pardon those people, no one's going to testify.
And then that protects the president, who, of course, is a co-conspirator.
If he was a co-conspirator, and it protects people, let's assume he wasn't. It protects people who may have committed crimes. In fact, it's particularly pernicious to do that. It removes any ability to hold an administration, that is to say, a government with immense power, accountable for transgressing on liberty or for disobeying the law. And when the government disobeys the law, it's a lot more dangerous than when any individual does.
Well, the hallmark of this administration, in effect, has been a preemptive one, engaging in preemptive activities that curtail civil liberties because an unlawful action may happen.
Well, I don't know that I would characterize as saying the hallmark of the administration is engaging in preemptive activities. I think the hallmark of the administration is stretching presidential power and administration power beyond all rational reading of statutes, and in invading liberty, torturing people, doing terrible things, and evading all the normal restrictions on the exercise of power, denying Congress's power, for example, or the court's power. And every time it comes to court, they end up losing, but it takes years.
How do you respond to critics who believe that there should not be a truth commission and rather things should proceed to criminal proceedings?
Well, I agree. Things should proceed to criminal. Doesn't mean this. Well, there should be a commission. I think there should be both. I don't know that I'd call it a truth commission, because the idea of the truth commission in South Africa and several other places was that you didn't do anything else afterwards. It's just getting at the facts as well. I think there should be called it a 9/11 type commission, but a commission with subpoena power that can get at the facts, that can have people testify, that can hold hearings, that can develop more information which prosecutors may then use.
Sort of like a grand jury.
Well, perhaps. I mean, remember before the Watergate prosecutions, you had the congressional investigations. And that helps elicit the information and publicize it and, as importantly, educate the American people as to why it's important to enforce the law, as to why you have these things. I mean, right now the narrative will be nobody did anything wrong. We protected the American people from terrorism. Why are you hounding these people who protect the American people from terrorism? You've got to educate people and say, hey, wait a minute. They tortured innocent people. They arranged for torture of possibly innocent people. They caused the recruitment of thousands and thousands of people to jihadist organizations because they were able to point to the United States doing terrible things, not being the beacon of liberty, being hypocritical, and educate the people as to why these prosecutions that may subsequently come are necessary and doable. Because you've got to set the stage. So I think there ought to be commissions and, if indicated, prosecutions.
Now, some people say that during the last few years, the American public has become numbed or passive regarding the issue of torture. We were shocked initially with the photos of Abu Ghraib, but then it became sort of an everyday word in a way. Do you think under a new administration, if we have these kinds of hearings, that people will listen?
Well, I think
listen?
That there has been a numbing. Not that people are more forgiving of real torture, but you pick up a newspaper, you don't see reference to the administration's torture policy. You see references to use of enhanced interrogation techniques.
They changed the language.
They changed the language.
Yeah.
Even read the New York Times. It's enhanced interrogation techniques. It's not alleged torture, which is what it should be. I think one of the functions of hearings is to say what happened. When you saw those pictures of Abu Ghraib, people were shocked. And people ought to see what was really going on. They'll be shocked again. It is very important in a democratic country that people know what was done in their name. When government acts, it's in the name of the people. And you bear responsibility. You evade that responsibility if you really don't know what's going on. And if you can't find it out, then it's not your responsibility. But you have to give people the opportunity to find it out. You have to show them what was done in their name and let them decide whether the people ought to be punished or held accountable or the policies changed. I mean, one of the problems we have in a democratic country today is that everything is secret. When there's secret, there's no accountability and there's no responsibility by the people either.
You introduced the resolution in late November. What are the next stages?
Well,
and what do you think the response will be?
Hopefully, the resolution is not going to be passed. I mean, we're only in session for a day or so when the order will be allowed.
Right.
We're not going to pass it in this, right. In this Congress. The purpose of the resolution was a shot across the administration's bow, really to say, hey, think before you do this because there's going to be a lot of repercussions. In the next Congress, we have the ability, the Congress that takes office in January, we have the ability to do things. If the president has exercised pardons, then there's very little we can do about those pardons. I'm going to introduce a constitutional amendment to restrict the pardon power for the future.
That will be a great legacy if that passes.
If it passes. Now, it's very hard to pass a constitutional amendment. It probably takes several years. I'm going to say two or three things in that constitutional amendment. I'm not sure the third yet. But one will say you cannot pardon anybody except for a crime of which they were already convicted. In other words, the purpose of a pardon is to temper justice with mercy. Fine. Temper it. But do the justice first. Let the facts come out. Let there be justice. And then people know what the president's really pardoning. Number two, say that you cannot pardon members of your own administration for official actions committed with respect to that administration. So you can't pardon, for all the reasons I said before. So you can't pardon and cover up illegal acts by your own administration. And finally, I think, this is one I'm not sure of yet, but probably we'll say that no president can exercise the pardon power in the last few months, 4 months, 6 months, I don't know, of his own administration. So a president should be held politically accountable, either in his running for re-election or conceivably before the election, because he strongly has an investment in seeing the candidate of his own party elected. And it should be done before the last election. So that's that. I also think, there are a number of things we have to do. This country has been very lawless. This administration has been very lawless. It's been very difficult to hold it accountable. And there's one other bill which I think is more important than almost anything else, and that's the bill I've introduced called on state secrets. Because how do you enforce rights? The Bill of Rights says, gives us all sorts of rights. But if the government tramples on it, if they come in and kidnap you out of your home, put you on a plane and send you to Egypt to be tortured, how do you enforce the right? Well, traditionally, that's half a dozen crimes. They can be prosecuted. But the administration can't prosecute themselves, or won't. The other way is you can sue. You sue in tort. You sue for false arrest, for false imprisonment, for torture, for bodily harm, all kinds of things. You sue the government, you sue the individuals who did it. But now the government comes in and moves to dismiss the lawsuit on the grounds of state secrets. That is to say, you must dismiss this lawsuit because trying the lawsuit will involve the public revelation of state secrets, which will endanger the national security, therefore dismiss the case. And many judges today will just dismiss that case. Now, so you can't get prosecuted, or you can't have a prosecution, and you can't sue at law, there is no remedy. And without a remedy, there's an old maxim in law, there's no remedy, there's no right without a remedy. And so the Bill of Rights becomes meaningless. So you've got to undo the state secrets. I've introduced a bill to do that, as to how to conduct trials and still protect real national security, but when it's really there, not just the government claiming it to hide embarrassing information. And also I'm going to introduce a bill to reestablish the old special prosecutor law, to enable a court to name a special prosecutor, even if the attorney general won't, with protection so we don't get another Ken Starr, which is why we let that law lapse. 1978, Congress passed a law called the Classified Information Protection Act, which provides for how do you handle really classified information in the context of a criminal trial. Someone is accused of murder or theft or whatever, and some of the information necessary for the defense or perhaps the prosecution is classified. How do you handle it while giving the person his legal and constitutional rights to due process and a fair trial and still protect national security? That law struck, I think, a pretty fair balance. It's worked well for 30 years, and the State Secrets Act is modeled on it and is designed to bring similar procedures into civil action so you can sue the government.
Congressman, thank you so much. We wish you the best of luck in your future endeavors, and
thank
we
you.
Really appreciate your time.
You're very welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Go now to hear excerpts from an event at New York University Law School titled Torture, a Harper's Magazine forum on justice in the post-Bush era. The event focused on a report written by contributing editor Scott Horton. A panel of legal experts discussed the methods available to a democracy for reckoning with the legacy of human rights abuses. We'll hear from our own Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Thank you all for being here. I want to address one point that Bert made about who's going to be pardoned here. If there's going to be pardons, they're not going to be lower level pardons. They're going to be a generic pardon that says anybody who violated certain laws is hereby pardoned. I mean, that's what I would say. They're not going to name people. They're going to give a generic pardon. And so then we're going to just be, in some sense, out in terms of criminal prosecutions. I mean, it's going to be very difficult to challenge. I agree with Liz. There's challenges, like can the president pardon himself? Or as Scott said once to me, Michael, can co-conspirator pardon other co-conspirators? Those are nice challenges. You know, the pardoning power is pretty broad. But I think, you know, if you look from the first memo of Gonzales, January 25th, 2002, it's all about avoiding criminal prosecution, and not just for the lower guys. It's for the upper guys. That's one thing. The second thing that was mentioned, Liz said she was the only prosecutor on the panel, and that's technically correct, although I did try and prosecute, as you heard, Rumsfeld in both France and in Germany, and we made the world very small for Donald Rumsfeld. I mean, he had to leave Germany immediately after we served the complaint, the criminal prosecutorial complaint. And one thing you should know about pardons is they don't apply to war crimes or to torture. And they may apply here in the United States. We could challenge it on the grounds that the pardons are against international law and against the fact that you cannot pardon war crimes, but they certainly are not going to apply in European prosecutions. So they may protect themselves here and they can walk around, you know, in the United States, but they're not going to walk so freely in Europe. As was said by Luke, our position at the center has been really since the beginning to favor a special prosecutor and to favor prosecutions. We first did a lot with civil cases, as Bert has mentioned. One of our cases, Maher Arar, is being argued. David Cole is actually coming in from the United Kingdom to argue the case. It's the case of the Canadian who was taken to the underground cell in Syria. It's one of the only cases that has even survived this far in terms of civil remedies. It hasn't been very successful. We've tried our German and our French cases again at this point without success, but luckily sitting out there we have Spain and Italy, which currently has 24 CIA agents on trial. So there's some hope. But my basic view here is, assuming there's no pardons in a generic way here, is that there has to be a special prosecutor appointed. And I say that really for a lot of the reasons that have been said. If Obama really said, and his quote is, make sure we don't torture, there's really no way, and I really, it takes up a little bit on Bert's comment, to make sure we don't torture or go off the law the next time around, unless there's a deterrence. The deterrence that's used for the smallest crimes, whether it's shoplifting, you know, or a mugging, is the deterrence of criminal prosecution. And the next time a CIA guy or next time a public official says, I want to waterboard somebody or put him in a coffin or give a guy 48 days of sleep deprivation, dogs and stripping, they'll think about it if they know they might get prosecuted. So I really believe you absolutely have to have a special prosecutor here. There's enough information out there. We don't need to know all the information. We know a lot. We have Karen Greenberg's great book, The Torture Papers. Josh Dreitel, I think the co-author, is here. Scores of memos in there, just memo after memo outlining the torture program that this country ran. We have Philip Sands' book. We have Jane Mayer's book, all really outlining the torture program. We know who the principals are. The members of the principals committee are the main ones, Tenet, Rumsfeld, Bush, Cheney. That's the principals committee. Then you have the war council, which is the lawyers, Addington, you, Gonzalez, you can name them. They're there. The evidence is there. A prosecutor has enough information here to go forward. And I read Scott's article, and Scott and I, as you can imagine, are quite close and discuss this all the time. And I thought the first half of the article was actually probably one of the best pieces I've read on the torture program in the United States. I mean, it has a line in there that makes you see why you need a criminal deterrence. What he says about the administration is that it waged war against the law itself, which means to say that all the laws you pass in the world, if Obama passes every executive order, if he reverses all of the memos and does all that, the next administration, and even conceivably this one, can figure out, just as Addington and you did, ways to twist the law and make it impossible to make that law applicable. And then you can go to the next step that Scott does describe in here, that they not only did that, but they actually thought they were above the law, that the president wasn't bound by the law, he wasn't bound by Congress, and he wasn't bound by the courts. Well, all the laws in the world can't stop the next president from saying, I'm not bound in the same way that President Bush was bound. The only thing that can do that, really the only thing, is special prosecutions. And so I read Scott's article the first half, where it really, I looked forward to seeing what the second half was going to be. And then I came to the second half, and the second half, it doesn't begin this way, but it starts with, given the political situation in the United States, a commission of inquiry is what we should do. That bothered me a lot, because my view about what our obligation is here as human rights lawyers, as people in the United States, is to insist on what's right and what's proper and what needs to be done to protect us the next time around. And the given political situation in the United States is not static, and it's already shifted, even partly because of this article, mostly in a positive way, because other people are beginning to talk about it, and people are writing op-eds and starting to deal with it. And they're actually, now you see Mukasey twice talk about pardons, because we're changing the political environment. And I'm not saying tomorrow Obama is going to appoint a special prosecutor. I don't know if it'll be him, it'll be the next president or somebody. But it's the right thing to be done here. And I don't like seeing a position taken this early on in the game, particularly based on political efficacy and the fact that that's what we're given the political situation in the United States. So I thought that sent alarm bells off, and I told Scott this, he knows that I didn't like seeing that, especially with the first half of an article that just was really punching at this administration. And then he says this, and then you read what the Commission of Inquiry is like. Scott and I were on a TV show the other day, and after we finished, they said, well, Michael, I think actually Scott's Commission of Inquiry is actually harder to implement than a special prosecutor, because you go through it. It says you need party-affiliated co-chairs. Well, a Republican and a Democrat are going to be the co-chairs of the commission. That's already probably the complete end of the game. Then it says choosing the people is a very difficult problem, and Scott addresses it. Really hard problem. The Speaker of the House, the Senate Majority Leader, and minority leaders. Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, was in on the meeting where she knew waterboarding was being approved. So we can't have that. Then Scott recognizes that's a problem. We got a problem here. So then he says a further layer will have a qualifications commission who chooses the candidates that these people then choose. Well, by that time, I'm building a superstructure I just think cannot get through at all. And if you talk about the problems of thinking of an administration that is dealing with all these huge problems out there, the economy, which is what I hear all the time, and everything else, you set up a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, call it a Commission of Inquiry, which is a much better word here, because there's no reconciliation here. This is not South Africa. This is not South America. This is not a fragile democracy in which there's a military ready to have a coup if we try and prosecute one of them, or at least I hope it's not.
We would welcome the coup, actually. Right.
But it's not that. So it's an inappropriate model for that reason as well, but it's certainly inappropriate. It's also inappropriate because even Scott admits in the article, although he says we could get prosecutions out of it eventually, he says it doesn't actually lead to justice. It doesn't seek justice. That's not what a truth commission does. So for all of those reasons, I can give you a lot more, but I really reject that as a model. I do think it's actually harder, that when you talk about wanting to not have the Obama administration divert itself, a three-year truth commission or a three-year commission of inquiry, that's going to be a diversion. A special prosecutor looking narrowly into the key figures who actually set up the torture program is really what you want to have happen here. So I just want to close by saying that it's not the time to be thinking of the compromises that people need to make because the Obama administration is only willing to go to a certain point. That's not our job. Our job is to insist this doesn't happen again, and there's only one way that I know it's not going to happen again, and that's criminal prosecution.
We'll hear from Bert Newborn, legal director at the Brennan Center for Justice, New York University.
It is an honor to be on this panel. It's a wonderful group. It's also wonderful to be reunited with Liz Holtzman again. There are many of you in the audience, as I look out, who are old enough to remember that Liz and I were the two who fought the Cambodian bombing cases in the early 70s. So we were existentialists even then. I want to focus on accountability is the theme. But this is not a new, you would think somehow that we're shocked to learn that during a period of crisis, we fell short of our constitutional obligations. It's an ugly thing to look in the mirror and say. I call it the deck chair theory of constitutional law, that we treat our Constitution as though it's a deck chair. And in nice weather, we sit out and we look at it and we admire it and we ask everybody to come and say what a wonderful chair it is. And then when it starts raining, we fold it up and put it away. And the reason that it's lasted for 230 years is that it's never gotten wet. if you look at the Alien and Sedition Acts, Congressman Lyon, who was the congressman from Vermont, died in prison. He died in prison as a political detainee. Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus during the Civil War. It's one thing to suspend it along the rail line to between Baltimore and Washington. He suspended it throughout the United States, and more than 10,000 people were imprisoned in military facilities for doing nothing more than opposing the war. World War I, the conscientious objectors and people who opposed the draft went to jail in droves, and we did nothing about it. World War II was Korematsu. The McCarthy era, the excesses of Vietnam, and now the excesses of 9/11. The truth of the matter is we have a panic button in the Constitution that we push, and it turns it off during periods of great fear. And we have never been able, after those periods are gone, to create the kind of accountability that will inhibit the pushing of the panic button. And until we do, we as a society have to expect that that panic button will be pushed every single time we're frightened. And so the commitment that we all, I think, share now is a commitment to try to establish some level of accountability now so that at least you deter the pushing of the panic button. Otherwise, we're going to get exactly what we deserve, which is exactly what we've had in the past, and that's a two-tier theory of law. During periods of crisis, the Constitution is thrown away. During periods of ordinary government, we congratulate ourselves on being a country of the rule of law. Now, it seems to me that there are a number of things we can do. Let me, as long as we're adding to Jerry's wonderful list, and let me say how grateful I am that he's there. Doing what he's doing in Washington. It's wonderful to have that voice. Here's one thing we could do tomorrow that would have tremendous effect on accountability. Let's not have any illusions. The president is going to pardon these people before he leaves office. What he's going to do is say, I don't have to issue a pardon because nothing they did was illegal. But I'm going to issue it anyway, just in case. So you're going to get one of these classic two-faced situations where he says, we're going to have to think about how we operate here in a pardon setting. But you know, I predict he's going to pardon too low. He's going to pardon the torturers. He's not going to pardon David Addington. He's not going to pardon Vice President Cheney. He's not going to pardon John Woo. He's not going to pardon the architects. He's going to pardon the low-level guys at the CIA who actually carried out the crimes, because nobody dreams that we would ever go after the high-ranking people with crimes. High-ranking people always get away. Even when you do criminal sanctions, it's always some low-level schlep who gets caught and takes the rap for the people at the top. If we're serious this time, then we ought to go after the people who made the policy, not the low-level people who carried it out. And I'll bet they're not going to be pardoned because they don't want the implication that they did anything wrong. So they're not going to be pardoned. The third thing is we have two other options that we could use. Three other options, actually. There are congressional hearings. Congressional hearings have a long and very important, and despite occasional lapses, as in the McCarthy era, an honorable position in our history. Congress doesn't need the president. I voted for Barack Obama with joy, and I look forward to having him as my president. But anybody that assumes power can't be trusted anymore. I've sued every American president since Lyndon Johnson, and it's only a matter of time till I get my hands on Barack Obama. So we can't trust him. He's not going to come on a white horse and fix everything for us. He now is saddled with the responsibility of being the president of the entire nation. And that's going to mean he's going to compromise. And that means we have to be prepared to step in, both to pressure him to minimize the compromise, and if necessary, to use Congress as an independent source of investigative authority to get to the basis of the facts if the president won't do it. Then the next possibility is to do what we did in the 50s and 60s with the Civil Rights Commission. The Civil Rights Commission that we think of now is just a sort of technical group that helps statutes get passed and they do statistics. In the 50s and 60s, the Civil Rights Commission was a roving commission that went through the South and held hearings in town after town and identified the racists, publicized who they were, made it clear who was threatening people because they were trying to vote, made it clear who was trying to inhibit the growth of equality, and they shamed and frightened a lot of these people out of stopping. Now, a shaming commission is something that we should be thinking of. Shaming works. Many of these people are going to go on to future careers. They want to be on boards. They want to be well respected. They want to be remembered as good people. Shaming is an important mechanism, and we shouldn't forget it. And then the final thing is a lesson that Mandela should teach us. We don't even begin to think about having endured what they endured. And so this is something that may be a little precious even to talk about. But the notion of truth and reconciliation as a way of getting to the bottom of much of this is important. It is important to have people come forward and say that they did something wrong. It is important for people then to say, we forgive you for that, because we want to go forward and get this behind us. And one of the things that we have to think about is, do we want to assume a retributive position, or do we want to assume something a little more subtle, like a truth and reconciliation position? Now, since I believe he's going to pardon lots of people, and if we start going down the criminal road, this is a society for good reason. We make it hard to prosecute people. There's the Fifth Amendment. We start making noises about criminal prosecution, all sources of information clam up, because anybody that gets called is going to take the Fifth. And one of the things that I'm thinking about is that if he pardons lots of people, there's no more Fifth Amendment privilege. And all of a sudden, we can get the facts. So I think one of the things, and Scott's article really got me thinking, it's a wonderful article. One of the things we have to think through is, systematically, how do we want to figure out our accountability strategy. And it has to be a strategy that will work, not just make us feel good because we make noise and shout and threaten, but that actually at the end of the day begins the process of stopping this horrible pattern that we have of simply collapsing every time there's a crisis. And maybe this can be the beginning of an accountability mechanism that will inhibit this from happening in the future.
Thank you.
That was an excerpt from the recent event at New York University Law School titled Torture, a Harper's Magazine forum on justice in the post-Bush era. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.